Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we have Dr. Richard Red Lawhorn. Dr. Lawhorn is a system engineer and operations research analyst who graduated his doctorate in engineering systems from UCLA in 1977. He is the spouse of a chronic facial pain patient, and he has advocated for pain patients and their family members for over 20 years by conducting, in addition to direct patient conversations, online research, physician referrals, and has authored numerous websites and critical commentaries. So thank you for having us, Red.
You're very welcome. I'm glad to help out.
Good. So before we begin, I want to ask a critical question that I think is important for the rest of the conversation. Oftentimes, you would describe yourself as a non-clinical or a non-physician subject matter expert. Do you see that as different from a patient advocate, or do you simply like the latter terminology?
I tend to use the latter terminology because it is most accurate. In fact, there is such a thing as board certification for patient advocates who are trained specifically in the resolution of insurance coverage matters. And I am not that. I don't have a board certification. I'm a subject matter expert, largely in the opinion of the thousands of people that I have contacted. I'm certainly not certified, and I don't want to misrepresent myself as that. You could say that the evidence for that description is best read in over 150 papers, articles, and interviews that have been published in the last 25 years, primarily in the last 10 years, and by the breadth of my contacts in social media and online. So I am a caregiver first, because my wife was the first person that engaged my concern and interest in this general field. And beyond that, I have, by self-study, I've made myself an expert on public policy with regard to the regulation of pain relief medicine and of opioids and of doctors that prescribe them. I hope that's responsive to your question.
No, it's perfect. Red, you are the perfect embodiment of the phrase, experience breeds expertise. And I want the audience to know that you have authored, as you had mentioned, numerous academic papers that have been published widely in peer-reviewed academic journals. And it's a testament to your perseverance and to the unique insight that you've provided over the years. Can you talk a little bit about how the pain conversation has changed when you first started advocating to where it is now?
Oh boy, over 25 years. Well, here are a couple of insights. When my wife first came down with trigeminal neuralgia, which is a form of chronic neuropathic face pain, we found our way with the help of a neurologist to a support group that was just really beginning to get active at that time. This National Trigeminal Neuralgia Association, it's now been rebranded to the Face Pain Association. And when I ask a question during a support group meeting, the founder of that organization crooked a finger at me and basically said, come on, talk. I want to see whether we might be able to learn from each other. And at that time, the disorder that my wife had been diagnosed with, if you did a Google search on it, you would have gotten in 1996 about 3,000 or so hits. As webmaster for the TN Association, I went to work on improving the visibility of that disorder and in numerous media online. And if you ran the same search today, you'd get something like 3,600,000 hits. Wow. Rather than 3,600 hits. So I can say that in the time I've been doing this work, quite a number of things have changed for the better, and quite a number of things have changed very substantially for the worse for pain patients generally, far beyond the immediate limitations of the field that surrounds face pain as a medical entity.
Sure. And, you know, we'll delve into some of the negative aspects in a moment, but I want to tease out a little bit more about your advocacy and just how effective it has been at a national level. You started as a webmaster and you improved visibility for the Face Pain Association, but now you're almost an authoritative source for disseminating new articles, disseminating op-eds. Did you learn from a very early time in advocating for patients that information dissemination is the key to success?
That word success is sometimes very elusive, and I don't want to misrepresent myself in that or the state of affairs in that. We're still dealing with a major, you could say, battle, and the term pain warriors is still very current in use in the social media. What we have going on now generally is what I would characterize as the near failure of the entire field of pain medicine and pain management medicine. Wow. And that is traceable to two things. One of them is the so-called war on drugs, which extends all the way back into the Nixon administration and the establishment of the DEA and the establishment of a very punitive, very law enforcement centered approach to issues that involve opioids particularly, and opioids are a major focus of the work that I do. And what we're seeing basically is the institutionalization, and that term is maybe a little large for what we're talking about, but the institutionalization and weaponization of an extremely false narrative. And it's being weaponized by no less than the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, Department of Justice, state attorneys general, and state medical boards. And the mythology that they are preaching and that they are founding legal prosecutions of doctors upon is the outright silly notion that prescribing an opioid will predispose a patient who hasn't used them before rapidly to addiction. That notion is absolutely disproven by the entirety of the medical literature, if you get into it deeply enough to understand what's really being said. But there are people out there who are advocating both with governments and with regulatory agencies for the abolishment of all opioid treatment. And those people, in my view, should be hung, drawn, quartered, and then left to stink in the public square. I'm a little bit hard over on that. So, apart from the ironic humor in that, what we have here is a vast misdirection of national policy. Yeah. And a very visible misdirection. So I was drawn into that particular mess by people who came to me and said, hey, I know you know an awful lot about treating face pain. I'm having other larger problems, and my doctor is refusing to treat me with the only medications that work. Mm-hmm. And those are opioid medications, they're opioid analgesics. And my doctor is very nervous about having himself sanctioned or having his license challenged or perhaps even being prosecuted. Because he sees the DEA basically pursuing a witch hunt, and he doesn't want to be an object of that witch hunt. And this kind of input started surfacing for me all the way back in 2010. I started seeing these kinds of discussions online and responding to them where I could, where I had some knowledge of the issue. And they prompted me to study a whole lot deeper on the policy level of the issues that are surrounding the treatment of chronic and acute pain with opioid analgesics. And I learned a lot, and that's, if anything, what has made me a subject matter expert on the field. I have files of bookmarks that are literally hundreds deep on this issue. So,
And Brad, it's no exaggeration to state that you have been at the forefront in promoting the data, promoting clinically sound evidence and literature to help rectify this narrative. Now, when people talk about this incongruency between the medical literature and this false narrative, there are no shortage of reasons as to why this discrepancy has occurred and perpetuates throughout our society. But for you, your perspective is probably more profound than most simply because of how active you are in the community. So beyond the whole ulterior motives or advocacy groups lobbying for this false narrative, why do you feel that this false narrative has been so pervasive throughout society?
The rule of thumb in these things is follow the money. And in this case, you have to follow the money to something that's very much current news because it illustrates many of the points that surround this issue. DEA and literally thousands of other government authorities went after Purdue Pharma on grounds that they had misrepresented the risks and benefits of opioids and that they were somehow responsible for the diversion of opioids into channels which basically created addicts. We know that's a damn lie. Pardon my French, or a darned lie if you want to patch this audio. We know that's a lie, and we know that the reality is vastly different from that, and the data prove it, and the data published by CDC prove it. But there are large numbers of people who have come to identify with the idea that opioids are a bad influence on medicine, period. Some of those people are actually doctors. Mm-hmm. Some of them are self-interested advocates who are also doctors. Some of them are expert witnesses for government actions against doctors. Others of them are affiliated with insurance companies that basically have a significant bias against the interests of chronic patients because chronic patients are loss leaders. They don't ever get better. Right. And when they don't get better, insurance companies have to go on paying out fairly substantial amounts for the maintenance of the lives of people who are never going to really go off the insurance rolls until they hit the lifetime limits on their insurance coverage. So there are multiple actors. Some of them are very much of the character of the folks that supported McCarthy in the 1950s. At least they have attitudes that are certainly very similar. Yeah. Others simply believe the mythology that they preach. And some indeed are financially self-interested. And then there's another and very, we want to be careful with this one. There's a very profound, but ultimately misdirected thrust on the part of people who have lost a family member to opioid addiction and who have more or less heard let's not get complicated. It's basically a false narrative that says when my Johnny went to the doctor with a sprained knee from his football practice, he came back with a bottle of Percocet and he took as many of them as he could all in one lump and he liked how he felt. And gosh, oh gee, a year later, he's dead.
Yeah.
And that narrative told by people who are in quite prominent positions, some of them affiliated even with the Kennedys, has been a very negative influence on this entire field because what that narrative really amounts to is emotional denial.
Yeah.
The people who are saying that my Johnny was addicted by a doctor all too often have failed to ask the question, where was I?
Yeah.
Why didn't I see my Johnny or Janie for that matter, circulating the drain? Why was I so preoccupied that I didn't see the signs? But they don't ask that question because it's a very deeply painful and personal question. And we have to give people in that position some significant empathy because they're hurting. They really, really are. That's genuine. It's genuine personal pain that motivates them to try to persecute doctors out of practice because they blame the doctors instead of themselves. I hope that's responsive.
No, you're right. And there needs to be a vast amount more empathy in this whole conversation that is lost when we get into the whole medical McCarthyism concept of perpetuating this false narrative. Red, I want to press you on something you had mentioned earlier because I think you're uniquely qualified to address this, and that's the insurance angle, not just identifying high-risk prescribers, but also identifying ways to optimize their bottom line through care services offered and care packages. Insurance companies have become a major player in the entire pain conversation in the opioid epidemic, yet they're not really well understood. Can you talk a little bit more about the role private insurance companies had in this whole debacle?
I wish I could. What I have to say to you on this is that the role of private insurers has been so steeped in secrecy and so undocumented from any point of view that you could actually find by doing online search, that it is very difficult to trace. There is one thing I think I can say in this. It's an example, it's not a conclusive proof. There's a very prominent figure associated with the organization Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing, or so-called PROP. The name on this is Andrew Kolodny. Andrew is one of the primary agitators for the abolishment of opioids in pain medicine. But rather unbeknownst to most people, he was also at one time the chief medical officer for Phoenix House, which is a chain of addiction recovery centers across the U.S., multi-hundreds of millions, certainly maybe more than $1 billion in revenue. And he was at one time at least a consultant, and I do not know with certainty if it got beyond that. He was a consultant to a national consortium of disability insurance companies. I don't know with certainty that he still is associated in that way, and I don't want to misrepresent him. That's something that we'd have to research pretty hard to find, because he's very carefully hidden it, and he almost never discusses it.
Yeah. You know, that level of secrecy is unique to pain. And what's interesting that most people don't realize is that those who are drafting the CDC guidelines, the revised guidelines, they're also under a cloak of secrecy as well. Why is there so much secrecy around the issue of pain at a government level?
Well, now here we're going to get into a little bit of speculation and a lot of fact, but I'll try to separate them. For one thing, CDC doesn't have a legal charter to be active in the establishment of either guidelines or standards for treatment. But they're in this business in large part because of relationships that were established between the then director of the CDC, which was a gentleman by the name of Friedman. I have a hard time remembering names these days. Sorry about that. But Friedman was the boss for Andrew Kolodny when they were both working for the New York State Department of Health. And Kolodny and his cohorts went to the FDA trying to get black box warnings imposed on all opioid analgesics. And the FDA threw them out and said, you guys don't really know what you're talking about in terms of the assertions that were being made between concerning risks versus benefits. Well, Kolodny went to Friedman and basically said, you guys need to start taking some action to suppress the use of opioids because they're dangerous. And we'll help you any way we possibly can. And what we're facing, according to Kolodny, is nothing less than an opioid epidemic, and that makes it CDC business.
Right.
Well, interestingly enough, there is no such thing, and there never was any such thing. Opioids and addiction are not communicable diseases. And they don't lie within the legislative charter of CDC. But CDC basically went in and engaged in a process that a military person would call mission creep. Mm. They expanded their dominance in that field, and they did it primarily through the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control that was headed up by a lady by the name of Deborah Howery, who I believe has primary credentials in public health rather than medicine. She may be an MD, and I frankly flatly forget right now. But at any rate, we can check that. That's easy. Sure. So Howery got the bit in her teeth and basically said, well, we really have to impose some order on all of this. And they went out in basically the period of around 2013 and 14, and they commissioned some studies through the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, and they picked up a working group, and then a group of peer reviewers from various places. And those people are named, if you dig hard enough to find all of the names. It's really hard to know for sure without a mountain of work exactly how much they know. But one of the things that I think was fascinating is that the group that they initially commissioned to look at this issue and try to develop guidelines didn't include, as far as I've ever been able to tell, anyone who is board certified and actually practices in community-based pain medicine. Nobody in that group was actually routinely working with pain patients. You had a whole lot of psychologists and psychiatrists and a number of people active in the public health and some pharmacists, but you didn't have anybody that really knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
Now, also a figure in this that's very key, and this is something you don't have to rely on me for. There's a very good literature for this. It turns out that at least one of the people who were principal authors of the 2016 guidelines and who continue to be very active in the rewriting of the guidelines is a gentleman by the name of Roger Chow. Roger works with the Oregon Research Hospital. That's not quite the right term. It's the OHSU is their term. Oregon Hospital. I'm going to have to back up. I don't have that figure in my head. Sorry. The bottom line, though, is that he has been principal author on a large number of studies that were published, outcome studies that were published by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. And he was also a selected member of the writers group for the first guidelines. He is a member of the Board of Scientific Advisors, which NCIPC has hired in to more or less provide oversight of their efforts. He was a sitting member of the opioid work group that was appointed in January of 2020. January 2020. So he's been a visible presence all through the process. And it turns out that he had a record of publication with PROP and with several members of the PROP executive board, which should have disqualified him from even being considered. Now, this entire train of logic is documented, or the entire train of misbehavior is documented in an article that was published by a gentleman by the name of Chad Collas, K-O-L-L-A-S, who is an MD and who is a fairly prominent member of the AMA and very much a participant in their process of consideration for what the guidelines ought to look like and what the standards ought to be. And what Collas has basically said, and you know, fair disclosure, a couple of my papers are referenced in his work, is that the entire CDC process, the internal process of selecting people to write and registering and advocating for the work of the people to write, has been corrupted from day one. And it has been corrupted by undue influence and unexamined assumptions and unexamined methodology, which, if you look at the details, clearly establishes a record of deep anti-opioid bias that is not supported by science.
Yeah.
So we, some of this mess, and it is a mess, as there's many, many threads in it. I don't want to be, you know, unfairly simplistic about this. Some of this mess is a consequence of people who don't have qualifications, but who have deep biases trying to stack the deck.
Yeah.
And that is very clear in the discussions that occurred on July 16th of this year, when NCIPC and their Board of Scientific Counselors had a meeting, a public meeting of their advisory board, the Board of Scientific Counselors, and of the group that did the oversight for progress so far and rewriting the guidelines from 2016.
Yeah, because let's go into that a little bit more about the process of revising the guidelines. Because as you had mentioned, the AMA has criticized the 2016 guidelines. You have led the forefront in criticizing the guidelines. How is the process of revising playing out? And how hopeful are you on a positive outcome to the revisions?
The interim report that was offered by the writers group and the interim examination of that report by the independent opioid work group reveals that the writers have basically doubled down on the same errors they made in 2016.
Wow.
And they've not only doubled down on it, they are quoting from the work of Roger Chow and others at AHRQ. And they haven't really examined, nobody has really examined except maybe me. And I realize that sounds a little odd, but that's just the way it is. Nobody has really examined the methodology that went into the AHRQ reports. And when you do, you find out that the methodology was deeply wrong and it was deeply misdirected and jumped to conclusions that the data don't support.
Yeah.
Another part of this that gets really, really interesting, and this is maybe a key point for your listeners to take away. The basic metric or measure of value that is used in the CDC guidelines is the idea that opioid prescriptions should be limited in dose and duration on some basic numeric basis. And the metric that's used in this is morphine milligram equivalent daily dose, MEDD. And the suggestion is made without support that nobody ought to receive a prescription of longer than 7 days ever for anything prior to review to determine whether there's anything useful. But the initial prescription should not be longer than 7 days. And for many patients, they're advocating 3 to 5 days. When you look at MMED, though, you run into a real serious problem. The FDA scheduled a stakeholders meeting in early June of this year, 7 to 8 June, in which they asked for contributions of both physician experience and science to try to lend greater fidelity and understanding to the models that are used in determining MMEDD, which is really a way of comparing one opioid to another opioid when you're treating a patient with it to decide what really is equivalent, how many milligrams of medication A are equivalent to 5 milligrams of medication B. When they looked at this, the comments that were registered with the Federal Register, and they're still available as far as I know, the comments basically revealed that there is no medical consensus on MMEDD. And in fact, it's a medical mythology. It's junk science.
Yeah.
The equivalency is false. We know it's false. And there are quite a number of authors writing and have been writing on this for the past 5 years. We're writing even at the time when the guideline was published. And AMA itself has also taken positions that basically say, you can't limit the number of MMED on a one size fits all basis. That doesn't work. It's not science. There's no justifiable reason for doing that. Stop.
Yeah.
That's really what it boils down to. So
I appreciate that. Brad, for the audience, can you talk a little bit about the significance of an AHRQ backed study, the implications of a study that comes out of that organization?
Yeah, what they are charged with doing, what their charter is they try to go and to do systematic outcome reviews to say, what is the state of literature? What do we know from medical literature and from the trials literature on key issues that are pertinent to the practice of medicine? What does the research tell us? What conclusions can we draw from it? And what are the implications? And they've done this in quite a wide variety of fields. Opioids is only one. They also do it in hospital practice for various procedures. They're basically a small group that are charged with the idea of determining, you know, do we really have a viable standard of practice? Do we have a science that supports that practice? And what are the primary considerations and concerns that should be applied when we're working in that particular field of medicine? They're almost unknown to the public.
very secretive. It's another instance of a healthcare organization that's also mired in secrecy. So the AHRQ, the FDA, the CDC, they each, as you had mentioned, have unique charters, but there's clearly, as you talked about, mission creep in all three organizations, but there's also an uncomfortable amount of overlap in organizations that really should be distinct as checks and balances.
Yeah, and the idea of checks and balances is unknown at present in government policy with regard to healthcare, period.
Yeah.
You've got basically the Centers for, what is the name I'm after? Basically, the HHS center that oversees Medicare practice, they are the 1,000-pound gorilla on the block, and what they tell practitioners they're allowed to do has a tendency to become required practice throughout American medicine. But CVS, Center, boy, I'm having a hard time with names Senate, this morning.
Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Right, CMS. CMS has been also a player in trying to suppress opioids. Some of the things that CVS has done basically amount to trying to suppress opioids without any basis at all. And one of the big areas where they've been active is in so-called overutilization criteria for studying people who are on high doses of opioids and trying to determine whether there's any relationship between high doses and misuse or addiction. And it turned out that a group of people published a letter, I believe, in the Journal of American Medicine, which basically says we've looked at like 6 years of data on the overutilization program. And what we find is that the predictions that are made by the analytic tools that CVS is employing don't really give you any significant reliable prediction of when someone on high doses of opioids is likely to become problematic or to experience a hospital admission or other action that indicates that there's been an overdose. Now, beside that, there's another factor that CVS is not responsible for. CDC publishes data every year from national surveys and from prescribing data that are put together by IQVIA, which is a private company that you will never ever be able to penetrate because they're just as impenetrable as the rest of this hierarchy.
Yep.
But one of the things that they did have done and that they were kind of forced to do is they published data on who gets prescriptions and who gets into trouble with opioid overdose deaths. And it turns out that the two of those things don't match up and never have.
Yep.
Seniors over age 62 are prescribed opioids for chronic pain control about 3 to 6 times more often than youth under age 19. But youth under age 19 have opioid overdose fatality rates that are 3 to 6 times higher than seniors. And moreover, the rates of overdose among kids and youth have skyrocketed during the last 20 years. And the rates among seniors have crept up slightly, but only as a result, probably only as a result of the aging of the addict population. Hmm. So what we get is two sets of contradicting data that CDC has religiously avoided ever putting together on the same page. Because when you do put them together on the same page, what you get is the understanding that there is no medical model of causation or cause and effect that can explain the fact that one group of people dies so much more often than the other, and the other group of people is prescribed opioids so much more often than the first. It really is what you call a demographic inversion, and no model of cause and effect that invests belief in the silly idea that opioids are the problem can possibly explain it. It's just not there. It never has been there.
Red, I think that is such an important point that you have been on the forefront of this demographic inversion and the demographic shifts in opioid use across different patient populations has been so instrumental in discerning the actual medical facts from the false narratives. And I would encourage anybody who is listening to go visit either the Lawhorn Files or Google Red Lawhorn to find out more about what he has just mentioned, because that is a pivotal fact that has been referenced numerous times by organizations like the American Medical Association and the Journal of American Medical Association as well.
May I offer one more addition to that, if I may? I'm not the only voice in this, and I don't want to, you know, overpromote myself on this. Turns out that there are a number of other authors. One of them is Jacob Sullum. Another is Michael Shatman. Jeffrey Singer has also published. They published years ago. And one of their articles, as a matter of fact, I believe is in Medscape. And it basically says yesterday's opioid patient is not today's addict. Right. And they also look at the data in that regard. And the data are gradually becoming quite clear, and they have been published in numerous places. And you know, some people are now taking the time to actually do the numbers over. And I've just recently published with two other authors another landmark article that does the same. It's in the journal Frontiers in Pain Research.
Can you give the name of that article?
Yeah, just a minute. Let me call it up online and be sure I have it right here. The name of the article is Opioids and Chronic Pain, an Analytic Review of the Clinical Evidence. It's with Stephen E. Nadeau and Jeffrey K. Wu.
Nadeau University of Florida.
Yeah, University of Florida. And a very experienced neurologist and researcher. The article itself is about 6,000 words long and contains 123 references that span the entire field of clinical evidence with regard to opioids and chronic pain. I personally think this article might become one of the more widely cited in medical literature once the experts catch up with it.
That's powerful. Red, let's do this. And I know that we're short on time. I want to leave you with one final question, and it's a big question. The DEA recently issued a public health alert, which was unprecedented. The CDC is set to release its revised guidelines either at the end of this year or beginning of next year. The AMA has very strongly advocated against the policies of the CDC and the DEA. And we're starting to see more and more literature and voices going against what was essentially gospel for many years in the false narratives of the opioid epidemic. If we were to tie everything that's going together, how do you see the next 8, 9, 10 months playing out?
I see a battle going on behind the scenes, a battle going on in secret spaces with people whose professional reputations have become associated with this myth, basically saying, I don't care what you think. I don't care what you think the evidence proves. What's right is to suppress opioids. That's one group of people. And their minds are going to have to get changed for them, probably by legislation, ultimately. And I'm encouraging pain patients and their caregivers and their professionals to engage with their legislators on this, because what we've got in Congress is basically blithering idiocy on the issues of pain management. These are people that don't have any expertise of their own. And even those who have practiced in medicine rarely have had any experience with opioids or with the use of opioids in chronic pain. So what we have here is a policy misdirection. Ultimately, and this is very long term, I think we're going to have to consider the decriminalization of narcotic medications just as a harm reduction measure. We know already from 20 years of experience in Portugal and other European countries that it works and that it saves lives. And we need very much to have that happen. Whether it will happen is going to depend on whether patients and their advocates can go on being visible and aggravating and uncompromising to tell the powers that be, guys, you messed up, resign.
Yeah.
It's about that clear.
Well, thank you so much, Red. I really appreciate your time and really appreciate your insight. Before I let you go, can you let the audience know how they can get a hold of you and how they can find your work online?
My work online is easy. You can enter a Google phrase on the Lawhern Files. It's spelled Lawhern. I can be reached by email. You'll have to be patient because I get a whole lot of mail from people. But I can be reached by email at lawhern@hotmail.com. And I do my very best to be responsive. I'm not always able to because of the volume. You can also find me on Facebook. Just look me up as Red Lawhern on Facebook, and you can observe my page there. I post a lot of my stuff there on an ongoing, timely basis. You can look me up on Quora, Q-U-O-R-A. You can look me up on LinkedIn. You can find me on Twitter. I am active in all of those venues, and I do my very best to be sure that what I do publish there is grounded on data, not opinion.
Thank you so much, sir. Really appreciate your time.
You're quite welcome.
Bye-bye.